And here I'm going to go back to Stephen Krashen, who is, of course, my hero in the research world. Stephen Krashen found an amazing thing, and it's buried deep in The Power of Reading. You have to look pretty hard. But I don't bury it because I think it's the most amazing piece of research he did. Krashen found that listening to formal language read out loud, which means language that's originally in the literary world, listening to formal language read out loud has almost the same language attainment effects as reading yourself. Stop and think about the implications of what I just said. You know those really nice teachers, the great ones, who let their kids read for 20 minutes a day in their classroom free reading? They're actually hurting their kids. Because they could take those 20 minutes, have the kids put down the book and read out loud to them, and the kids would get just as much out of hearing them. The funny thing is, the kids will get more out of listening to someone read out loud than reading themselves, because in any group of kids reading on their own, there's six kids in the back, they're all boys, and they're holding the book upside down. And they're flipping the pages the wrong way, because they're not reading. So reading out loud to kids really does have the same effect. And of course, that means if you want kids reading 6 hours a day, all you have to do is read to them for 6 hours a day. None of you want to do that. Let me tell you, I spend my life talking 6 hours a day. I've got two of my former students in this room right now. They know I will talk for 6 hours at a stretch without any problem until my voice goes. That's when you give them the books on CD. Books on CD, audiobooks, downloadable books, playaways, any form of audiobook has not only the advantage of there's no way of getting tired, but the readers are pros. They're good at it. Remember back some of us in the early days, an audiobook came from the National Service for the Blind, and they were terrible. They were all volunteer readers. You know, people who were reading textbooks and stuff, and the audio quality was horrible, and the readers were terrible. Now you get all out-of-work actors. Oh, my goodness. Those are wonderful. Yep.
If you take more questions, and I know that people online aren't hearing this, if you take more questions, be sure to repeat the questions.
Yep.
We don't have
mics here. Okay.
But hopefully we can just sort of launch into the presentation.
Okay, yep. We're going to do that in about 2 minutes. For those of you who didn't hear that point, that was Susan Babb. Saying that if I'm going to answer questions, I really need to repeat the questions. So I suppose I should repeat that little piece of directions. So you guys actually hear it too. So we're talking about, you know, what about books on CD, audiobooks? And the fact of the matter is the research says that kids get just as much out of hearing books read out loud as they do out of reading them themselves. That means if we want kids reading in volume, which we're going to talk about again this afternoon, audiobooks are a wonderful answer, especially downloadable ones, because they have one added advantage, and that is they're technological. You add computers and techno tricks in there, and you've added a level of complexity that is very appealing to boys. And we'll talk about why that is this afternoon. I love audiobooks. I don't like downloadables as much, but frankly, my local library out in Tulsa has all but stopped buying books on CD. Audiobooks are the wave of the future, so even I am downloading audiobooks onto an MP3 player. God forbid. A troglodyte that I am. Yes?
Also, the thing about CDs and the school setting, I'm not sure about the public library, kids hear it together. When you get a group and they've all heard it together. We had a few of the kids listening last year, even though they were readers,
yeah.
It made them more chatty about it.
So the point that was just made for those of you out in techno land is, in schools especially, the other advantage of audio CDs is that it can be a shared experience. I'm going to amen that as strongly as I possibly can, with the one simple caveat, and I can see a few people's faces turned up as soon as you heard that, and that is, no one's quite decided whether that falls under fair use or not. There may be a copyright issue when it comes to that. It's going to take 10 years for that to be fought out in courts. Yes, fair use. If you read the book out loud to a group of kids, there's no question that that is fair use. If you use a commercial vendor, and pretty much any audio CD is going to come from a commercial vendor these days, there's still some question about that. The fact of the matter is you'll never get sued for it, because who cares? The question is whether, as a librarian, with our code of ethics, you want to avoid doing it if it turns out to be illegal anyways. My take on it at this point is no one has said formally and definitively that it's illegal yet, so I'm going to keep doing it until someone tells me to stop. But certainly a shared experience is a wonderful thing. We talked this morning about kids not reading in isolation, reading in a supportive environment. And that's certainly a good thing. All right. Are we ready to talk about books? Let's talk about books. The folks here in Marlboro have had to put up with 3 hours of educational theory. Pity them. We did all the theoretical work this morning. The boring stuff is done. Now let's talk about what we really all got into this for, and that is books. And I want to sort of turn our heads around and start thinking in the right direction by reading you an email that I got soon after I published my first book for kids at least, my first children's book, Escapade Johnson and Mayhem at Mount Moosawak. That tells you, by the way, a little bit about my literary taste right there. I wish you could see the cover. I know those of you out in the ether world are seeing a lot of, will be seeing a lot of my website while we're doing this, and hopefully you'll see the cover. This is obviously not aimed to be fine literature. When it was first published, though, I got this email almost immediately. It says, "Dear Mike, I'm a grandmother and love to buy books for my 9-year-old grandson." So immediately I love this woman. This is my target audience. "I saw the article in the Portsmouth Herald about your books. I immediately went to Barnes & Noble in Portsmouth to check them out." Okay, I have a problem with her now. Of course, she didn't go to her local library, which could very well have been mine. I was running a library in Greenland at the time. I went to Barnes & Noble. "I always read the entire book to see if it is proper for my grandson, without cursing, improper behavior, etc., before I give it to him. Now I know I'm in trouble." Anyone who knows me knows this is going to get bad fast. "I took it home and read the book. On the whole, it's a wonderful book, a fun story with a lot of adventure. I liked how you juxtapose the wealthy children with the middle-class children," which has to be the first and only Marxist interpretation of my work I've ever found. I have no idea what she's talking about, by the way. If you've read the books, I don't know. But there are 8 pages that I find inappropriate for my grandson." She then goes on to list the pages with page numbers, things like the boys throwing spitballs at the teacher every day, substitute teachers being locked in the boiler room, filling the hairnets of the cafeteria ladies with bugs before they could put them on, second graders being chased up trees by enormous dogs, leaping on a desk, falling off, hitting his head on the tile floor — that was Jimmy, if you know my series — removing screws from the teacher's chair. By the way, I stole. Everyone know where that first showed up in print? Robert Cormier, Chocolate War. So that one wasn't even my fault. Bringing pet cockroaches to school, and Sherilyn and Katrina gluing Davy's pants to a chair, pulling the boy's pants down around his ankles, and my personal favorite, scat was fine, poop wasn't necessary. Which, by the way, will be the title of my autobiography, should I be lucky enough to write one someday. And if not, it's going on my tombstone. I really do like the story a lot. It's the perfect type of adventure boys would love to read, but it can be just as much fun and exciting without the above-mentioned. Sincerely, Fran. Grandma Fran was wrong. The book would not have been nearly as funny or adventurous without the things she mentioned. In fact, she picked the 8 best parts. If you want to just get through my book very quickly and read all the good parts, there they are. Just pick the pages she wrote out. That's fine. But she really started to bug me with a comment that said that she'd been a Title I teacher for many years and had never in her life experienced children doing the sorts of things that I was talking about, and didn't believe that kids would ever do those things. And what I resisted the urge to get into the argument. I didn't respond. But everything in that book I'd seen kids do. I didn't make up any of it. I just spent an entire summer writing down all the stupid things that I'd heard real kids do that I'd seen kids do or that I had done when I was that age. What really bugs me is it shows a real lack of understanding of what I consider to be the type of literature that boys really like. What I've coined boys' literature. And oddly enough, if that phrase sounds familiar to you, it's only about 6 years old. The first time it showed up in print was an article that I wrote for School Library Journal 6 years ago. It's not something we ever talked about before that. We might have talked about the concept, but we hadn't put a name on it yet. It's a fairly new idea that there's certain types of books that really do appeal to boys. I know people have thought about that for generations, but we never really talked about it. We never really said it. And I'm not talking about all boys here. I'm talking in generalities. I know kids are individuals. I started my life as a special needs teacher. I understand every kid's an individual. I get that. But there are certain types of books that do appeal to large groups of kids. And what's really special about boys' lit is the large group of kids that this really appeals to tends to be where our reading problems really are. There is no book that every kid's going to love. There is no book that every boy's going to love. And there is no book that boys are going to love and no girls are going to love. But there are books that do appeal to large numbers of boys, and especially the boys that are resistant or reluctant readers. Those two terms, by the way, do not refer to the same thing. There's a difference between a resistant and a reluctant reader. And if you've ever stood there and try and force a book into a boy's hands, you know the difference. A reluctant reader will take a book and give it a try and read the first three chapters and then throw the book away and say, boy, there's another terrible book that an adult gave me. A resistant reader will tell you, I'm not a reader. They're a whole different animal. I'm going to talk a lot about both of those kind of groups today. So hold on, we're going to have some wonderful horror stories from 20 years on the front lines here with kids. Who are the boys that I'm talking about? Well, I'm talking about the boys that for 30 years have scored lower than girls on every reading test we've given them in America. I'm talking about the boys that flunk out at four times the rate of girls. I'm talking about the boys that identify themselves as young as age 8 as non-readers and tell you right to your face, I don't read. I was one of those kids, by the way. When I was a freshman in high school, I was very fond of telling my teachers, you can make me read things, but I have never voluntarily read a book in my life. I was that obnoxious teenage boy that so many of you run into every single day. So I know of what I speak, and I'll talk a lot about my experiences, and I will tell you about the librarian who saved my reading life. It's the most inspirational story I have, so I saved it to the end of the day here, and we'll get to that. Why is it so hard to reach these boys? Why is it so hard to reach the kind of kids that I'm talking about? Well, we mentioned this morning, but I got to repeat it one more time. You know, boys and girls are just different. And you can talk about brain differences and when the brain develops and how the brain develops. And everyone can sort of deal with that because you can put it up on a computer screen. You can take a brain scan. You can say, look, see those red marks? They're different in boys than they are in girls. There's a psychological difference as well, and that's a little harder to get across. Psychology is one of those fuzzy sciences, right? We never want to talk about it because if you want to start an argument, get two psychiatrists in a room and ask them a question and they will argue with each other. I'm not going to talk about high-level psychology. This is Psych 101. I want to talk about a difference between boys and girls that every psychologist in the world will nod their head and say, yep, I get this one. You know that boys and girls just see the world differently. Adult males and adult females do too. But psychologically, children are purists. We are what we were psychologically as kids. But as kids, we were more so. We mellow over the time. So if what I tell you makes a little bit of sense, understand that if it makes a little bit of sense at this point in your life, as a child, it would make all the sense in the world. Boys and girls tend to see the world just a little differently. Girls tend to internalize. Boys tend to externalize. What does that mean? Well, let me quote one of America's greatest psychologists. His name is Jeff Foxworthy. I always judge my audience by how much of a laugh I get at that. I currently am living in Oklahoma, and when I use that line, everyone breaks out laughing. Not as much country fans around here. Jeff Foxworthy, of course, is the great country comedian. You might be a redneck if you remember that line. That's Jeff Foxworthy. And he loves to tell a story about how he has two daughters, ages 9 and 12. His brother lives in the house next door to him, has three daughters, ages 7, 9, and 12. The Foxworthy grandparents have 9 grandchildren, all girls, all between the ages of 7 and 12. He lives in the world of the pre-adolescent girl. Pity him. Can you just imagine what he calls the naked Barbie ocean? That's his world. And he says he loves it. He's learned so much about girls by living with so many of them. But he does admit that he spends most of his time running around trying to figure out what people are crying about. Because, you know, girls might be just a little more emotional than boys. There's a reason for that. And I know that's a terrible generality. It also happens to be true. So you can yell at me for being a generalist, but listen to me on this one. Girls do tend to be more emotional, and it has to do with this basic psychological difference. Girls internalize. They see a big, wide, wonderful, interesting world and figure everything out there has a reflection in me. If there's goodness in the world, there must be goodness in me. If there's evil in the world, well, there must be evil in me. It's what allows girls to feel other people's emotions, feel empathy, feel sympathy. They see a puppy suffering and they feel its pain. Wonderful. Boys, not so much, right? He's likely the one causing the puppy the pain. And it's because they see the world just a little bit differently. They see a big, wide, wonderful, interesting world and figure if I don't get out there quick, it's going to pass me by. They feel disconnected to the world around them. That's what makes them an externalist. The world is out there and I am here and there's a gulf, there's a separation. It's one of the reasons so many boys are experiential learners. They feel that gulf and they have to cross it. And if they don't cross it, they don't care. If I can't touch it, if I can't feel it, it doesn't matter. It's usually the boy who's asking in school, when am I ever going to use this in real life? Interestingly enough, they ask that question in English class all the time. But they ask that. They want to feel a connection with the world around them. And if they don't feel that connection, they don't care. It separates them. And it's a very hard thing for an awful lot of women to see this difference. One, because it feels so academic. And two, once you really see that difference, man, it's a gulf that's hard to cross. There's a researcher named Leonard Sachs, wrote a wonderful book called Why Gender Matters. And he theorizes this is why boys engage in so much risky behavior. We all know this is true, right? Boys are far more likely to put themselves in mortal, physical, emotional, and spiritual danger on a regular basis. And it's just barbaric. Why do they do this? I remember, you know, my former wife and I having this discussion as I was rubbing one of my sore joints and saying, oh, yeah, that's the thumb I broke back in junior high. You broke your thumb? I've never had a broken bone. What? I've broken every bone in my body. And it's just something. I was one of those guys that put themselves in danger all the time. Leonard Sachs said this is the way it basically works. You ask any kid, 10 years old, especially any boy, and they'll tell you, if someone were to take their bike to the roof of this building and ride it off, they would probably get hurt. They get that. They understand that. What are they going to do now that you put the idea in his head? Yeah, they're going to take their bike to the roof and ride it off. Because the fact that they would get hurt has no effect on me. I need to try it. I need to connect to it, even if that connection breaks my arm. This got really hit home to me. I was writing a book called Serving Boys Through Readers Advisory, where I tell that story. And I was telling that story at a restaurant at dinner with my sister Ginger and her son David, my nephew, teenage boy. And David stops me and says, oh, I have a story. You can use it everywhere you go. And he was right, because I'm still telling the story. He proceeds to tell the story while my sister Ginger sits there with her head in her hands. She had not heard this before. David told the story of how he was in Samburton, New Hampshire, a little town up in New Hampshire, out back of his house, riding a tractor, when he realized that the rear brakes in this tractor could be engaged separately. Okay, three people laughed. The rest of them need an explanation. Obviously not country kids, are you? What does every red-blooded American boy do with this piece of information? He took off across the field behind his house as fast as he could in this tractor, ripped on one of the brakes, and did tractor donuts for the whole afternoon. At least until he flipped the tractor over on his head. Crawls out from the wreck. He wasn't hurt. Gets out his cell phone. Calls his dad, because there's no way in heaven's name he's calling mom. Dad comes out with the truck and the chain. Wraps chain around the tractor. Pulls it back on his wheels. No harm, no foul, right? That's the end of the story? No, it's not the end of the story. Dad, who is a police officer in New Hampshire, a responsible human being, having just seen what happened to his son, has to get on the tractor and try it himself. Because it doesn't matter if he got hurt. I need to try it myself. That's how persistent. Welcome to the dark corner that is the mind of a teenage boy, or an adult man for that matter. This is a real difference, and it's a hard thing to cross. You say, what does it matter? Why would I bring that up on a day when we talk about reading? How does this affect reading? Well, it affects reading because it affects problem solving. Everybody wants to do good in this world. That's a part of the natural human nature. Everyone wants to do good in this world. And children learn how to do good in this world by playing. Just the way lion cubs do. They learn how to be adults. Lion cubs know that fighting is going to be something that they learn to do when they're adults. So they play fighting when they're kids. And adults play, or children play all the things that they're going to play as adults. We don't give kids enough playtime anymore. But one of the ways that they learn how to be adults is through their reading. And that means they learn how to solve problems. But how you do good in this world has an awful lot to do with how you see the world operating. Think about it. Take a problem. Here's a problem. Show it to a 10-year-old girl. There's a problem. Is that 10-year-old girl going to solve that problem? No. She's going to get her on her little texting device. She's going to call 50 of her friends. And going to say, hey, look, there's a problem. Are they going to solve the problem? No. They're all going to call 50 of their friends. And when there's 500 people staring at that problem doesn't have a chance. Why would you jump in and try and solve a problem all by yourself when you get 500 of your friends together, solve the problem all at once, and then have cookies and lemonade for the rest of the afternoon? That's an effective way to solve problems, right? You see a problem, you agree on the problem, you agree on a solution, you work together, you solve the problem. Sound good? Sounds wonderful if you're female. If you're a guy, let me tell you, that's a committee. Committees never did anything right. Right? A camel is a horse designed by a committee. As far as guys are concerned, that's the way it works. You show that problem to a 10-year-old boy, what's he going to do? He's going to pick it up. He's going to fix the problem or die trying. Why would you show me a problem if you didn't want me to solve it? And it's because of this difference in outlook. Girls tend to think that problems are solved through cooperation and communication. The social approach to life. That's how you solve problems. Guys tend to use the Home Depot approach to life. Rules and tools. Show me how the world works. Why does that problem exist in the first place? Help me to understand how to manipulate things to make it better. And I'm a happy guy. Do you realize how disconnected that approach is? Just stop and think about it. It's all I and me. There's no idea of bringing other people into this problem. Psychologically, guys think the world works on an ordered rules and tools approach to life. Is that going to affect what boys read? Oh, God, yes. It's going to affect how they read. Absolutely. Is it going to affect how we promote reading to kids? Only if you want it to work. Otherwise, we're spinning our wheels, and we do an awful lot of spinning our wheels. We really do a terrible job. And I can say this because, you know, we're librarians. We're in a room. There's no one else who can hear this. We as librarians do a terrible job of promoting reading to most boys. And I know that sounds harsh, but hopefully we'll come to a joint understanding of how that affects kids. Boys reading gets no respect because we don't understand why boys read. We don't understand that boys are reading to understand their world around them because our approach to reading tends to be so different. We approach reading as if the most important part of a book is the characters. But women and girls tend to read for characterization. Why? Because the world works in cooperation and communication. If you want to become a better adult and you're a 10-year-old girl, you want to read about people working together to solve problems, which means characters are the most important part of your reading. If you're a boy, characters don't matter because characters are just people. Actions matter. If you think the world works on rules and tools, you're going to read to see how actions affect the future. So what's the most important part of literature if you're a boy? Plot. Plot is everything. I really found this out when I was at Oyster River Middle School in Durham, New Hampshire. And their boys' book group had actually read Man of Mount Musilak. And so they invited me to come in and talk to their book group. And the teacher, being a good teacher, actually she was a teacher librarian, she was the librarian there, asked the boys, what did you like about the book? I thought I was a humor writer. I thought I wrote funny books. No. Universally, every kid answered, it's the action. That's what caught them. Humor is great, but they wanted the action. Then the teacher asked them the golden question. Okay, what didn't you like about the book? And the alpha dog in the group, no question who the alpha male was. None at all. He pops up immediately and says, you see this page here? And pointed to one of the pages. He said, nothing happened on this page. Wow. He picked the one page that had no plot element in it at all. If it was a Sharon Creech book, he'd have 437 choices. One page didn't have any action on it, and he picked it up. Boy, is that an amazing thing. Boys really do read for plot. And so plot-based stories are the ones that are really going to draw on them. The problem is, we don't have a way as librarians or literature enthusiasts really to honor that. Because in America, we use three words as if they meant exactly the same thing. And everyone's guilty of it. I'm guilty of it. And I'll give examples as we go. But we use the term literature, fiction, and novel as if they were all the same thing. And we do it all the time. And boy, when we get to the end, I'm really going to hammer that. But stop and think. Arguably, half of the literature we produce for children is nonfiction. And the vast majority of the fiction that we produce for kids is not novels. We use that term novel all the time. I hear the term fantasy novel, and it just makes my skin crawl. Maybe I'm just too much of a professor at heart. But there's no such thing as a fantasy novel. It's either a novel or it's fantasy. A novel is a very specific thing. Here I am, a main character, a protagonist. I have an internal flaw. There's something wrong with my personality. I'm going to spend the entire book cooperating and communicating with other characters, working my way through this problem so that I will come out on the other side a better person. It's bibliotherapy, right? Better living through literature? So much better than our answer in the 1970s, right? Boy, there were two people in this room that got that joke. All right, go back and to see a documentary from the 70s. You'll get that. But the fact of the matter is, that's what we want kids to do, right? We want kids to be able to improve themselves through their reading. It's a lovely thought. You have to understand how absolutely female-oriented that thought really is. It really does betray the fact that we think the world works in cooperation and communication. That's how we improve ourselves. That's what matters. That's what a novel is. I'm going to talk about a number of genres here, and the genres are genres largely because they aren't novels. Think about your basic sports book, and you know what? We really aren't talking about that kind of a procedure. I know. Frodo Baggins, in the ultimate fantasy series ever, Frodo Baggins does in fact learn a few things about himself during the 1,800 pages of the Lord of the Rings series. Is that the point of the books? No. It's a side effect. That's a story about a plot, getting from point A to point B, literally getting from the Shire to Mordor. There's a literal journey involved. It's one of the things that holds together a lot of boys' literature, is that plot really is the dominant factor. All right, enough general descriptions. What is it in literature that boys really like? When it comes down to boys' literature, what is the number one answer? And the funny thing is, you all know the types of books that boys like. I don't have to tell you this. Just shout out all the different categories when we talk about boys' life. What do they like to read? Humor, action-adventure, mystery, conflict, which comes down to, when you talk about historical fiction for boys, they're war books. Okay, good. Bathroom humor books. Not just humor, but gross, disgusting, bodily function humor. Yeah. Guinness. Nonsense, factoid, what we call encyclopedic non-fiction. Big one there. Boy, we hit just about all of them. It's always odd, the last one that we hit. Sci-fi? Fantasy? Disaster? Oh, you're getting very close. Graphic novels? Visuals? Dystopia, which is a subcategory of fantasy? There's one more subcategory of fantasy no one ever wants to talk about. Someone said it. Horror, very good. You hit them all. By the way, anyone who's got the handout in front of you? Yeah. They're all listed. You just have to... Come on, people.
We're listening to you.
Ah, that's wonderful. So you guys all know this. I don't have to tell you that. You know that even without looking. But it's not enough to know what kinds of books boys like. It's important to know why they like them and to know a few basic things about these genres and these types of books that are going to help you to promote reading to boys. So the number one answer, the answer that should have been your number one, that took some dragging out, it's nonfiction. You talk about the ultimate in boys' reading. Roy Doron's researcher in Canada got a government grant up there to do a wonderful test. He sat in classroom libraries, in elementary libraries, K through 6, elementary classrooms, and watched when the kids had free reading assignments and marked down which kids took which book out of the classroom library. Boys in this survey, I'm talking 10,000 free reading choices. This is not a small sampling. 10,000 free reading choices. The boys in his survey chose 3 nonfiction books for every 4 fiction books. We think of nonfiction as something that kids look up information in nonfiction. They read fiction. Roy Doron found it really wasn't so. Given a free chance to read, almost half of their reading was nonfiction for boys. Girls, of course, almost opposite. 1 nonfiction book for 3-4 fiction. Boys chose almost half of their reading nonfiction. Then Doron went in and counted up the books in the classroom library. They were 85% fiction. It tells us 2 things. First, boys really loved nonfiction. If they found half of their reading in nonfiction, despite the fact there was virtually no nonfiction to choose from, man, they loved nonfiction. What's the second thing we learn? We don't get it. Or we wouldn't build classroom libraries that are 85% fiction. But we do it all the time. This got hammered home to me. A couple of years back, I was down in Houston, Texas. And they were opening a new school building, with a huge new library. It was gorgeous. And before I went to talk to the faculty about boys and reading, they gave me a tour of this new library. And the library had 2 enormous wings, with carved wooden signs hanging above them. And on one wing, it said, nonfiction. And on the other side, it said, reading books. Man, I almost had a heart attack. They were proud of this. But it's because we really think kids look up stuff in nonfiction. And part of it is, you mentioned one of the greatest books ever for boys being the Guinness Book of World Records. And we think, wow, boys go and look stuff up there. No, they'll sit there for an hour flipping through and reading more things over and over. Encyclopedic nonfiction, you know the best one ever written? Oh, yuck, the Encyclopedia of Everything Nasty. Oh, my goodness, that should be on every desk in every library in the country. Let me tell you, you want a really great book talk? Oh, yuck is the best, because you pick up the book, you ask a kid, give me a number between 1 and 199. Whatever number they give you, open up to that page, read the first paragraph, and the kid's going to be dying laughing. And you've sold the book. You know why? Because they're going to get copies themselves. They're going to look up the most disgusting thing in the entire book. And the next time you ask them, they're going to know what page to send you to. What's more effective than a book talk than that? You just got the kids to go and read the book all on their own just to embarrass you. That's a great book talk. Nonfiction really does feed boys' need to understand the world around them. The funny thing is, we teach in our schools as if fiction were the only vehicle for language there is. When we teach kids to read, and especially when we teach kids to write, we teach it through fiction. How many kids are going to grow up to read fiction for a living? It's terrible. Most of them won't. I do, and I know how lucky I am. I review for a website. But most kids aren't. Most kids are going to have to write in their life at some point, but how many of them are going to get to write fiction? How many people write fiction for their job? Politicians, yeah, okay. But other than that, a few economists maybe, but no. We should be teaching language through nonfiction, not just because boys love it so much, but because that's far more realistic. As librarians, we have to understand, when a kid comes in, and I'm not going to name the book, one, because I don't want to embarrass the author, who's very good, and two, because I can't remember all the information. But I just read one of the most recent books from my publisher, ALA Editions, American Library Association, on Reader's Advisory. And in the opening paragraph, it says, Reader's Advisory is our wonderful opportunity as librarians. Kids come in looking for a book to read, and we give them some fiction. That was the opening paragraph. And, of course, I had just written a book a year earlier called Serving Boys Through Reader's Advisory that said exactly the opposite. When you do Reader's Advisory, your number one concern should be giving them nonfiction. But it's really hard for us to get our minds around that sometimes. Nonfiction really is the answer when it comes to boys in literature. But it can't be the only answer, right? There are other things that we can give kids. I love to ask people all the time, especially men, this wonderful question. What was the book? And I ask it, I'm not going to embarrass anyone here in front of them, but women have a hard time answering that question. They don't always understand exactly what I mean. What do you mean, what was the book? And guys know right off the top of their heads. They know the first book that ever caught them. They can remember. It was only 6 months ago. You know? They have that answer right on the tip of the tongue. Most of you women probably don't remember the first book that affected you. You don't remember a time when you weren't a reader. That's because you weren't in dummy reading in third grade, like one out of every three boys in America. I remember the first book. There's two basic answers I get when I ask that question. The first answer I get in most cases is comic books. When we talk about boys' literature, let's look at this entire group of books that we're going to call what? Comic books? Go ahead and say it. What was the term?
Graphic novels.
God, I hate that term. Can everyone now, I've set you up, can you tell me what's wrong with that term? Novels. Half of the graphic novels are nonfiction. And most of the rest of them are clearly in the genres. I've seen almost no graphic novels. They don't exist. And if they do, they're literary novels that have been transferred into graphic form. But that's the term that we librarians invented. That's our fault. You can't blame teachers. You can't blame publishers. Librarians invented that term because we don't see any difference between literature, fiction, and novel. I like to call it graphic literature. One of my best friends in the library world is really pushing for sequential art. I love that term. I just don't think it has any chance of catching on. But I like to point out that, you know, if we make that distinction, if we don't make the distinction between novels, fiction, and literature, well, let's make that distinction and say we're going to give it the most general term, graphic literature. Unfortunately, as soon as you say that, everyone thinks it's pornography. Okay, that's not too bad. If you want to sell a book to boys, get them thinking that way. I don't care if you lie. We'll get back to that. But graphic literature, I really think, is the answer. The problem is we tend to go halfway when it comes to graphic literature. In fact, we tend to go halfway in all types of boys' literature. I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes basically insulting some of your favorite books and your favorite authors. I'm so sorry. Let me apologize ahead of time. But we have this terrible tendency of saying, look, we don't really like what boys like to read. We want them to read the good stuff, which is, of course, what we think is good. So we're going to find something that has some appeal to us and some appeal to boys. Terrible approach. Why? Because if you're trying to reach the boys that are really resistant readers, especially resistant, not just the reluctant readers, you can't go halfway and answer that. Graphic novels is not the answer. What we call graphic novels really isn't the answer, although a lot of us think, what we call graphic novels, that's a great approach to boys. No, it's a good approach to boys, and good is not nearly good enough. Go to Barnes & Noble sometime on a Saturday. Sit there for 2 hours and watch the graphic novel section. It's usually 3 or 4 shelves. And just sit there and watch it for 2 hours and see who shows up to look at it. You're likely to see 2 adults thumb through it. They're both librarians. Let me just tell you that ahead of time. Then look at the manga section. Oh, yeah. Now you're going to see the kids sitting on the floor. It's 37 shelves because Barnes & Noble knows what sells. You're going to see a whole bunch of kids, especially teenagers, hanging around the manga section, sitting on the floor cross-legged, pulling the books off the shelf and flipping through the books and wondering why some of them are wrapped in plastic. Again, 4 people got that joke. The rest of you need to go to Barnes & Noble. Pick up one of those books that's in plastic. Go ahead and buy it. Take it home and read it. Then you'll know exactly why it's wrapped in plastic. Same reason that those books behind at the back of the magazine shelf are wrapped in brown paper. They can be just a little more risque. And that is the gripe, the sort of drawback of what we call manga. For those of you who don't know the difference, is Robin here? Robin was supposed to be here. I feel terrible talking about this in the state of the greatest graphic novel person in all of the country. If you want to know about graphic literature, as I call it, talk to Robin Brennan over in Brookline, and she knows it all. But let me tell you the difference. Manga is serialized graphic fiction. It is continuous stories in the form we used to do serialized short stories and serialized novels, but it's a story that goes on for often 20, 50, 70, 100 editions. Cheap paper, black and white, and it has this reputation for being a little sexy, a little sexist, which is really not good. Girls don't always come out very well in manga. Ironically, in Japan, manga is primarily a girl format. But it caught on in America so much with the boys that the stuff that gets translated in English tends to be the stuff that's more boy-friendly. So in America, if you take a look at manga, you're going to see an awful lot of boy-friendly stuff. It tends to be a little violent, too. My favorite manga is Nejima, Master Nejimaji. Clean ripoff of Harry Potter. Right? It's about a 10-year-old wizard whiz kid who graduates from wizard college 12 years ahead of his class. And his first assignment is to go teach English at an all-girls Japanese boarding school. And the jokes just roll from there. It's a wonderful series. My favorite is the one I carry around a lot when I'm not, you know, traveling halfway across the country, is the edition that has a big yellow sticker on it that says, for older teens, 14 and older. You know why they put that sticker on there? Yeah, to make sure every 12-year-old in America reads that book. There's nothing in that book that they're not going to see on primetime television. There's precious little that they're not going to see on family hour television. Which would you rather? The kids spend their time watching primetime television or reading the manga? You know what? You want them reading the manga. So give it to them. And you know what? It's good stuff. I love it. Be careful of going halfway. And be careful getting too caught up in all the hoopla about how bad graphic literature is for kids. Fact of the matter is, the reason people say graphic literature is dangerous is because pictures are powerful. Power is neutral. Pictures are strong. Pictures highlight and emphasize both halves of the brain. It gets cross-brain communication going. It's visual stimuli. Kids can actually read at a higher level when they're reading illustrated works because it sparks the brain. Also, the pictures give them huge clues as to what's going on. So even if they don't understand the words, they can follow the story, and it gives them more of that story structure I talked about this morning. Visual literature is powerful stuff. And power is dangerous. I understand that. But always I go back to the fact that they're going to get their stories one way or another. They're either going to get them on television or they're going to get them in a book. You might as well have them experience it in a literature-rich environment. So comic books saved an entire generation of boy readers. Awful lot of men today are readers because of comic books when they were kids. But the number two answer was the answer that came that saved me. It's the number two answer I get when I ask men, what was the book? Let me tell you about how I became a reader. I told you that I was a high schooler who had never voluntarily read a book in his life. How did I end up being a librarian and eventually a library school professor and an author? Well, Laura Lucello, not to make too fine a point of it, a school librarian. When I was off at Kimball Union Academy, Meriden, New Hampshire, I was a 10th grader, and Laura Lucello was my school librarian, and she knew I was not a reader. So one day when I was walking by the desk, she put a brown paper envelope on the desk, slid it across the desk to me, and said, don't tell anyone I gave you that book. Took the book, slid it under my arm, snuck back to my dorm, spent the next two nights with the blanket over my head and the flashlight out, reading that book cover to cover, looking for all the good parts. There weren't any. The book she gave me was The Hobbit by Tolkien. She lied to me. She made me think that this was going to be some dirty book I wasn't supposed to get my hands on. And she did it because she knew that once I read it, I'd be hooked. She was dead right. I spent the next month reading the entire Lord of the Rings series cover to cover and have read it about every year since and have never stopped reading. Why? Because when you talk about boys' literature, man, the number one fiction option is usually fantasy. Fantasy speaks to boys on an almost molecular level. Remember what I told you about the basic structure of a novel? The basic structure of fantasy is so different. It basically runs like this. Here I am, a little assistant pig keeper on a tiny little farm in the outskirts of the world, and there are armies marching through the woods just outside of my farm. And if I don't get out there quick, they're going to march to end the world, and then they're going to do it without me. Everyone get the reference? Lloyd Alexander, of course, the prototypical high fantasy writer. And that basic structure fits boys' external point of view perfectly. I need to go out, physically go out into the world and make my place because the world is not going to come to me. That's a very different structure than a novel. Which, you know, which is why when you get to Tamara Pierce, you need to either call it a novel or call it fiction, because it clearly is it both, and you can guess where I would put it. Tamara Pierce is not the answer when it comes to boys and fantasy. We don't have to worry about boys and fantasy these days, right? Isn't it a great time to be a fantasy reader? You all have Harry Potter. You don't need to worry about your fantasy collection, right? No. Yeah, it's not the wrong answer. It's the halfway answer. And I told you I'm going to insult your favorite authors. Sorry, but Rowling really is it. Harry Potter is not fantasy. Harry Potter is not anything. That's its charm. Sure, there are fantasy elements in it, but there are school story elements in it too. A la Andrew Clements, right? The great school story writer. Anyone want to call Harry Potter a school story? God, no. There are romance elements. Is it a romance book? No. Heavens, no. There are mystery elements, but it's not a mystery. That's its charm. That's why so many people love Harry Potter. Whether you're 7 or 70, or a boy, a girl, an adult, a child, it doesn't matter. Everybody loved Harry Potter, right? Researchers have gone back, though, and looked and started calling the Harry Potter effect. And it's not that so many reluctant readers suddenly became readers. It's not that so many 8-year-olds started reading well above their reading level. It's how many of those readers, as soon as they finished Harry Potter, went right back to their old ways. It's the thin effect that Harry Potter had. We all looked at Harry Potter as the savior of the reluctant readers. The problem is, most of the kids that were turned on to reading by Harry Potter simply stopped when Harry Potter was done. Why? Because there's a little bit there to drag them, but there's not enough. And it's largely our fault. We saw that 8-year-old who had never read anything before suddenly reading an 800-page book. And when he finished, we gave him Gone with the Wind. I don't think it was the 800 pages that drew him. It was probably the fantasy elements. Once they get hooked on Harry Potter, if you've got a boy who wasn't a reader get hooked on Harry Potter, you got to give him some real fantasy after that. Something dark, something millennial, something Game of Thrones. All right. Now you're on the right track. That's a good... Well, it's a little adult for most of those 8-year-olds. But yeah, now you're thinking. How about the Bartimaeus trilogy? Ooh, there's some dark stuff. Talk about a great series. In the first book in the series, a magician draws the magic circle to bring the demon into this world to do his bidding. He missed the circle. He didn't make it quite right. The demon got out and ate the magician. Yeah, now we're talking fantasy. Jonathan Stroud is a real fantasy writer. How about Sword of Shannara? A classic. How about David Eddings? You can give adult books to kids because in fantasy, there's in real high fantasy, there's usually no sex. There's very few girls. Tolkien actually makes the joke in his book about the belief that there are no troll women. You know why he makes that joke? Name all the troll women in the Tolkien series. There aren't any. There are no troll women. There are no dwarf women. There's virtually no. There's a couple of elf women. Although if all you know is the movie, Peter Jackson put a lot more females in that book. He just couldn't have a movie with as small a female presence as the series itself had. The books aren't about that. They're about making your place in the world. Why does fantasy have to be so dark? Well, because the basic psychological answer is fantasy allows kids to look at their life at arm's distance, just the way so many boys like it. It's not that boys don't want to talk about feelings. They just don't want to talk about their feelings. Feelings are fine as long as they don't affect me. Remember that arm's distance that boys have. They want to explore the issues in their lives, but not too closely. You say, really? We're talking about real life? How does any boy associate their life with trolls and dwarves and dragons? Because they don't have to make that connection directly. Fantasy is dark because the only way they can explore the end of their life is by exploring the end of the world. Fantasy is a recreation of the life cycle in miniature for the reader. And so the only way they can deal with their own mortality, if they are projecting themselves into the world, is to contemplate the end of the world. It has to be dark, it has to be millennial, or it just isn't going to catch them. Which is why, of course, Tamara Pierce doesn't count. So there's nothing wrong with her. She writes some wonderful stuff. It just isn't fantasy. It's novels with fantasy elements in them, which is fine in its place. But Don't give a reluctant boy reader who finished Harry Potter Tamara Pierce any more than you would give him Gone with the Wind, because you're not connecting him with the thing that really makes a difference. Have I insulted enough of your favorite authors now when it comes to fantasy? I'm so sorry. But Laura Lucello turned me around in one day. That's what kind of effect we can have on boys. Schools aren't going to solve the boys' reading problem. People are going to solve the boys' reading problem. And librarians are just uniquely situated to solve that problem. All right. Science fiction, of course, is much the same format. Please don't tell a science fiction buff that science fiction is just a sidelight of fantasy. They will go crazy on you. I know the difference. I get it. But structurally, literally, in literature terms, fantasy and science fiction are closely related. As is, of course, that one thing that no one ever wants to say. When I ask everybody, what are the formats that boys love so much, the last one I have to tease out is always horror. You were the one who came up with that, right? Very good. You a horror reader? Read some horror. Good, that's strong of you. It's really hard sometimes, isn't it? Yeah, I was going to say, but yeah, good. Well, at least we have R.L. Stein, right? So you don't have to worry too much about it. Everyone gets that one, right? Everyone knows that R.L. Stein is the halfway answer. Here's the bad news. That means if R.L. Stein is too much for you to handle, you're in trouble. R.L. Stein is really, really weak stuff. Horror, of course, is the flip side of fantasy. Both of them deal with the ultimate battle of good and evil. Fantasy is looking at that battle over the shoulder of good. Horror is looking over that over the shoulder of evil, which makes it a much darker, much harder thing for adults to deal with. And quite frankly, if you think the world operates by communication and cooperation, one of the central themes of horror is that communication and cooperation feeds the fires of chaos. This is not an easy thing for that mindset to approach. And this is one of the reasons gothic horror is so hard for a lot of women to accept, and why, as an extreme boy, that may be a much better calling even than fantasy. If R.L. Stein is your answer when it comes to horror, let me introduce you to a man named Darren Shan, the freak, the Cirque de Freak, which is, Darren Krepsley is the new series spinoff of that. It's also called The Vampire's Assistant, depending on which publisher you're looking at. This is really horror suspense in the classic family of Stephen King. Everyone here read The Shining? Oh, more than I usually get. Almost a third of this room raised their hand, even if they quickly put it back down when they realize what they just said. Almost a third, that's pretty good. The Shining is, of course, the ultimate example of gothic horror. It is looking at the world over the shadow of evil. It's a lovely book. How many people die in it? Go back and think. You got it. She's got one finger up. One person. They talk about a lot of people dying. A lot of people died in the past. But only one person dies in that book. Because it's not about killing. It's about suspense. It's about that shadow of evil, the things that go bump in the night. It's not the things in the darkness that scare us. It's the darkness that scares us. That's the underpinning of gothic horror. And you don't need a lot of blood and guts to do that. How many people die in the first two books in the Cirque de Freak series combined? One. Oh, yeah, I was going to say, how many people have read the Cirque de Freak series? Okay. Oh, thank goodness. A few people read one. I was going to have a heart attack there. Wow, you've got to read this. It has this terrible reputation, and adults hate it. Adults burn it, ban it. Because it's about a kid becoming a vampire. What a horrible thing. It's a thing that even Buffy the Vampire Slayer was hesitant to touch. But only one person dies in the first two episodes combined. Just like in The Shining. It's about suspense. If you've got By the way, the four-year-old, Dripping Fang, The Secrets of Dripping Fang, there actually is a horror series for those kids. Isn't it a funny series? Yeah. It's comic horror. If you've got a fourth grader who wants to read Stephen King, give him Darren Chan's Cirque de Freak. If you got a sixth grader who wants to read Stephen King, give him Darren Shan's older series, The Demonata. That's the one that really does have blood and guts and giblets flying through the air. But it happens in demon dimensions. It's a little more cartoony. It's very much separated. A lot of women have trouble reading it as much because it just doesn't make any sense. Who cares if people are killing or demons are killing each other in a demon dimension? You don't understand the arm's length part of that. But it's a wonderful horror series, and the best of the bunch, they have to get into Beck, which is just, Beck, frankly, should have won a Prince. I'm so sorry, it was that good a book. No librarian read it to possibly put it up for consideration, because it's about 7 books deep in the series. And by then, there are just too many giblets flying for most librarians to handle. If you got an 8th grader who wants to read Stephen King, who do you give him? Stephen King, very good. You guys are right with the program. Fact of the matter is, if I'm reading Tolkien at that point, you shouldn't have a problem with reading King. Stephen King really is a great writer. You just have to get past the picture of what's her name holding a sledgehammer. Who is Kathy Bates holding a sledgehammer? You can get past that, you're fine. So we got fantasy, science fiction, and horror all in the same category. Magical realism in that category. Neil Schusterman, of course, is the master of that. His recent book, Bruiser, about a boy. Have you read that one?
Yeah, I read that
one. Oh, okay. Good, we have one. Hey, who else? There are a lot of librarians that haven't read Darren Shan. You're fine. How many people have read Unwind by Schusterman? Yeah. Second one's out now. I haven't got my hands on it. The reserve list at my library is 400 long. Why? Because as much as we say we're honoring everyone's reading taste, I'm sorry, but the follow-up to Unwind, you shouldn't have a reserve list of 400 people on it, even in Tulsa. You haven't bought enough copies. But Bruiser is a recent one you have to read about magical realism. Magical realism is a fantasy world that's only separate from our world by one tiny little thing. It makes it real and unreal at the same time and has a lot of draw to boys if it's done right. If the fantasy element really is that strong. All right. Neil Gaiman will possibly play with that some. I was going to say, the Graveyard book is a true gothic horror, but it's not much past magical realism and a lot of his stuff. Yeah, now you're thinking about the right kind of authors. We'll make fun of the wrong kind of authors there in just a few minutes. I'm not done with those. Magical realism is one of those things where you really can pretend you're writing a boy book and not be doing it. And that comes up a lot. So we have fantasy, nonfiction, the graphic literature. How about sports? Sports going to appeal to boys? Of course it's going to appeal to boys. One, because boys are active creatures. I'm not saying girls aren't. Remember, 3 of my nieces wrestled in high school. But that's not my topic. Boys are active creatures. They want to read about people doing things that they associate with. Plus, a lot of sports books are so identifiably male. And the odd thing is, you find a lot of boys like sports books even if the main characters are girls. Because there's so much sports in them. I don't have to tell you about this. You don't have to worry about it because, of course, we've got Matt Christopher for the younger kids and Chris Crutcher for the older kids. So sports are covered in our public libraries, right? Wrong. Get used to this. It was not a rhetorical question. I want to hear the answer. It was a bad question. It was wrong. And I'm so sorry, especially when it comes to Chris Crutcher. Talk about an author that I just absolutely love. But he's not a sports writer. Staying Fat for Sarah Burns is not a sports book. It is a novel with sports in it, which is really true about everything that Matt Christopher ever wrote. Sports was never the focus of Matt Christopher. He was writing about the human experience. Matt Christopher for the younger kids. Same is going to be true for Chris Crutcher. It's just easier for me to pick on Matt Christopher because I think he was a hack. Chris Crutcher is a wonderful writer, and I don't even want to touch him. He's so good. But Matt Christopher is pretty easy to see the distinction. He didn't care about sports. I've had boys walk up to me and say, do you think this guy ever played football? No, I can tell you Matt Christopher never played football. In one of his books, he forgets how many points a field goal is. They're three, not two. You got it confused with the two-point conversion one. No, it was actually, I'm reading the book, I think you got it confused with the two-point conversion. He didn't care about the sports. The sports were there to draw in the reader so he could do the real work, which is to write about relationships. Nothing wrong with that, but don't expect that to catch a boy. It's a halfway answer. It's a chance to try and get boys in to read the stuff we want them to read, which is not the approach I'm talking about. You want real sports? Mike Lupica. You don't even have to write that down. It should be all over your book list there. Mike Lupica was a big I think he still is. Yeah, he's still right. I was going to say, I know he's... Yeah, that wasn't what I was about to say. I think he's still writing at least part-time in the New York sports pages. He's been writing big-time sports in New York for 30 years. Kids believe it when he writes. His best was Heat. And Heat was that wonderful book. It was after the Danny Amato story. Everyone remember Danny Amato? We're close enough to New York to remember this. Danny Amato was that little league pitcher who was 6 inches taller than everybody else. He was a kid who had escaped from Cuba on a boat, came to America, the ultimate success story. Playing in Little League, he was bigger. He was throwing an 82-mile-an-hour fastball in Little League. Kid was amazing. But the problem is, of course, every other coach in Little League Baseball took one look at this kid and said, I want some proof. I want to see a birth certificate. He came on a boat from Cuba. He doesn't have a birth certificate, and it's not like they're going to give it to him. How do you prove you're 12 years old when you floated over on a flotilla from Cuba? And he brought his team all the way to the Little League Finals, facing all of that controversy the whole time. His team came in second. He actually couldn't pitch in the finals because of the Little League rules. He had pitched too many innings. But you know what? He brought his team all the way to the finals of the Little League World Series. A wonderful story. Until, 6 months after the Little League Finals, they found out he was 14. He really did lie about his age. They were right. Oh, horrors. Heat was written in the aftermath of that about another Cuban boy who really was 12, but now that Danny Amato had set the standard, no one was going to believe him. And all the kid wanted to do was play ball. That's the beauty of Mike Lupica. He writes about small-time sports, about kids playing for the joy of playing and all those obnoxious adults that try and get in his way. His buddy John Feinstein writes about big-time sports. He writes about all those obnoxious adults that get in the way of the kids that Mike Lupica's writing about. He writes about the Final Four and the Super Bowl and the World Series and all those wonderful things. You put the two of them together, they're an amazing connection. And by the way, Jim Candy by Carl Duker. If you've got high schoolers and you want to prove that you're the coolest kid in town, every high school football player should read Carl Duker's Jim Candy. It's about steroid use. And it's not a moralistic, just say no to drugs kind of book. It's a book about kids who have real reasons to take steroids and the real consequences. It is gross, it is obnoxious and disgusting, and the language is harsh, and it is the most real book about sports you're ever going to read. That's your ticket to gain some real credibility with especially your tough high school boys. In sports, action-adventure. I don't even have to talk about action-adventure, of course, because you got Gary Paulson. So let's just go on. Wrong! Oh, and this one, again, you're talking about really ripping out my heart because I love Gary Paulson. And he has written a couple of very boy books. Most of them aren't action-adventure books. Hatchet will qualify. That's the book that gave him the chops as an action-adventure writer. Even the follow-ups to that aren't real action-adventure boy books. It's too cerebral. Too much in your head. It's the book you give to boys after they get hooked on action-adventure, when they're much, much older. If it's the first book you give them, it's like giving a separate piece to a 7-year-old with no context. You're going to turn them off literature forever. That's when I got it. I was in 7th grade, and I didn't read it. I read it when I was 32 years old, and I loved it. Good thing I wasn't a reader back then, isn't it? Gary Paulson, I once heard a professor give a talk where he proposed that dog song never happened. The entire book was a dream sequence. go back and read the book with that in your head, and it's a different book. Because there's a dream sequence in the book. Mm-hmm. Way too cerebral for what I'm talking about. We're talking really about Will Hobbs, Dan Gutman, and the king of all action-adventure writers, Ben Mikkelsen. Touching Spirit Bear, someone brought up earlier. The ultimate cheesy, mythological, hero kind of book. And I don't care how cheesy it is, it speaks to boys on a mythological level, and they just absolutely love it. And frankly, the boy eats his own vomit because that's all he can do, and most adults can't get past that page. Right? He finally catches a fish, he eats it, he's been starving for 4 days, food hits your stomach when you haven't eaten in 4 days, he throws it back up, and he's lying on the ground looking at it and realizing, that's the only food I've got. He eats it again. Talk about a book that gains credibility. You know, you're hitting boys right where they live. They're going to listen. Plus, it hammers that hero mentality so hard. Survival, absolutely. I'm still trying to think of the name of the book with the bear. Anyone come up with it? It may even be on your list. Yeah, I'll come up with it later. But that's the one where I heard someone talking about the book. About going and living out in the woods with the bear cub that you raised, and the entire talk was about the boy and his alcoholic father. What a way to kill an action-adventure book. Action-adventure speaks to boys not just because it's physical, but because it really talks about going out and finding your way in the world in a way that really does seem practical. And you're sitting here saying, how many boys get a chance to raise a bear cub and live in the woods with a bear cub? Doesn't matter. It's an experience they can connect with because it's an experience that's at arm's length and helps them work out their kind of issues. And now we've gotten to humor. Not just humor. What was the kind of humor that boys like? Gross, disgusting, potty humor, bodily function humor. This is what all boys' literature really has in common. All boys' literature, what holds all of them together is two basic facts. One, we don't respect it. And the reason we don't respect it is, two, it's all the edge. Here is your definition of boys' literature. And I had a woman who was the librarian at a Catholic school ask me this question straight out. She said, I like what you're saying. I respect all this stuff. I love the books you're talking about. I can't have them in my school because we have policies against these sort of things. What do I do? I can't have boys' literature. I said, sure you can have boys' literature. Because it isn't the gross, it isn't the disgusting, and it isn't the violent, and it isn't the sexy that makes it boys' lit. It's the fact that it's edgy. It's on the edge. All you have to do is find books that are edgy, that are within your category. Edgy for whatever reason comes along. Why? Because boys are explorers. Being external thinkers, boys want to explore the world around them. And no one explores the center of the map. People have already been there, right? Remember those old maps? They didn't know what was outside the center. What did they write in the edges of those maps? Here be dragons, right? Sometimes here be monsters, if it was water, or here be sea serpents. Why would they write those things on the map? Were they trying to discourage exploration? No! They wanted to make sure someone would go look. And the people who went to look were generally males, right? Who else would sail off to a place where you're either going to meet a dragon or fall off the end of the earth? That would have to be a guy. Most women are smarter than that, right? Guys love to be edgy. When it comes right down to it, why do boys love the things that drive us crazy? Because it drives us crazy. That's the point. Doesn't it seem like boys go out and break rules for absolutely no reason? Yes. When I was in high school, every year, beginning of the year, they would get us all together, the whole school in the big auditorium, and hand out a 26-page booklet called the Student Handbook. Mm-hmm. All the rules in school. And they would give us the speech. Respect the school, respect each other, respect yourself, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, yeah, whatever. Every boy knew that that was a handbook on how to get kicked out of school. If you needed a 2-week vacation, there were 136 good places to start. Every year, the evening after this little presentation, all the guys in my dorm would get together in the common area with our handbook and our highlighters. It was a tradition. We would sit in a circle and we would highlight in the new rule book all the rules that we had already broken and tell stories to each other about how we'd broken them. And some of them were actually true. But here's the kicker. You know why we did it? What was the point of this activity? Bonding? There's a woman's answer, isn't it? It's all about socialization. Nope, sorry, I'm going to give you a glimpse into the dark corner. Competition's closer. One-upmanship, you're starting to work that way. But that wasn't the real point. There was an end point to this. There was a finish line. Nope, you're still thinking in woman terms. Who can do the most? You know, what to do next? No, it was a contest. Who could break every rule first? First one to finish the book wins. Boy, the mind of a 14-year-old boy is a dark place to be, isn't it? It's just hard to think in those terms. But let me tell you, boys are like dogs. In so many ways. But in this way especially. Ever had a dog and you put an electric dog fence up? You know those invisible fences? You put up the invisible fence, you put a collar on the dog, and what do you hear for the first 2 weeks? Zip, yep, zip, yep, zip, yep. That dog tries every inch of that fence. He's finding out where the fence is. He can't see it either. And once he knows where it is, what's he going to do? No, he's going to run the circle in the inside of it. He'll know where the fence is because there'll be a dirt track 6 inches inside that fence. He needs to know where the boundaries are. Boys are exactly the same way. They need to know where the boundaries are. And how do you know where the bounds are? You don't dance over them every now and then. Man, that is the trick to boys' literature in a sentence right there. That's what boys want. Is it terrible to hand someone a book with one hand over your nose? Nope, not bad at all. Because that's what so many boys want. And you can even make a joke about it. I wouldn't read this book if you put a gun to my head. You're going to love it. I don't have a problem giving a boy a book like that. One of my favorite book talks, and it used to happen in Greenland, New Hampshire. I've talked a lot about that library. There was a teacher in the fifth grade at the elementary school right next door to my public library. Every time there was a school shooting in the news, I'd get a call, say, Mike, how'd you like to come in and do some book talking? That was the entire conversation. Yep, I'll be there. I knew exactly what she wanted. She knew I knew. I would go in. She'd introduce me to her class. Go get a cup of coffee. It's called plausible deniability. I wasn't there. I have no idea what happened in that room. I'd book talk for 20 minutes and then do the book talk that she wanted me to do. With Todd Strasser, Give a Boy a Gun. And if you haven't seen the cover, it's these little stick figure guys with red bullet holes in them. It's all about a Columbine-style shooting where kids go in and literally shoot their teachers and their classmates. It is a really tough book, and it really is written for fifth graders. Todd Strasser will tell you, oh, God, yes. Todd Strasser will tell you these kids are about 3 years older than the kids that he wants reading the book. Because that's the formula, by the way, for reaching boys, is write about kids that are 3 years older than and write 2 years below their grade level. Todd Strasser's Give a Boy a Gun is written at about a fourth grade reading level. It's plenty accessible to fifth graders. No questions asked. And you know what? Boys needed that book. Why? Not because boys don't read violence because they want to be violent. They read violence because they need to understand this thing is so foreign in their world. We've made their world so protected and so safe. And I know, I used to work in Everett. Not all boys live in a safe environment. But you know what? Most of them live in an environment that's safer than what they see on television. Violence is a foreign commodity in their world. And they need to understand it. And they're going to find out about violence because they need to understand the world around them. They're going to find out about it either through the media. Is that a good idea? Yeah, media handles violence so well. Right? Because there are no long-term consequences. All problems need to be solved in 30, 60, or 90 minutes. And so action becomes violence, and violence solves problems because you got to solve the problems. The media doesn't handle language well either. Right? How many words did Arnold Schwarzenegger use in his last movie? 6, 7? How many of them could you understand? Fact of the matter is, language doesn't translate well to the screen. Action does, and action turns into violence when you're trying to solve problems. Right? And you know what? There are no long-term consequences in media. Remember South Park? Remember the first 5 seasons? A character died at the end of every single episode of South Park. And for those of you who've never seen South Park with the blank faces, you don't understand. The same character died at the end of every single episode. Kenny dies at the end of every week's episode. And the next week, he's back. No explanation, he's just there. How can there be long-term consequences when characters can just roll back in? Books give you a chance to work through consequences, and there are consequences in Give a Boy a Gun. Fact of the matter is, it's a much better way for boys to explore their world in a language-rich environment. In short, get over it, which is literally the joke I use with parents. You find out where you stand with parents very quickly when you use that line. Either they laugh and you know you've got them, or they don't and you know that your job's on the line. You just need to not worry about being fired. I know. Hey, you know, the worst that can happen, right? You get fired, you get a better paying job anywhere other than in the library world. Think in those terms. It is so hard for us to give these extreme kind of books to kids. I'm trying to think of which story to tell because I got time for one of those two stories. Let me tell you about the book reviewing that I do. You've all got book lists in your handouts there. That's a teaser, by the way. There's, 100, 120 titles on there. My website has over 600 titles, and it's updated every week. I updated it last night with a brand new, wonderful, magical realism book I just read. It's called Touched, by the way, if you can find it. I can't remember the author's name. Go to my website. You'll see it on the front page. I review books for this website, Books for Boys. And so publishers and librarians and parents and teachers and everyone else either send me books, in the case of publishers, or titles and say, man, these are wonderful books for boys. You should put them on your list. My God, you should see some of the stuff they send me. It is absolutely painful. And what really kills me is that these are books that people really think, especially publishers, really think have boy appeal. In the last 2 years, some of the books that I've read that have been sent to me, A Village Defeats the Vampires by Holding Hands and Singing at Them. Yeah. Anyone remember the book? Vampirates. Go read it. It's hilariously funny. Don't give it to boys. Don't give it to anyone. It's a stupid, stupid premise. I'm so glad. What that tells me is you're not giving them anything better. I'm so sorry. It's an all-boys school. And Vampirates is the best you can do then? Oh, and that wasn't, actually, that wasn't even the same series. I'm about to pick on Vampirates. It's actually worse than them singing at the Vampires. The solution in Vampirates isn't them singing to the vampires, right? Remember? He saves his sister. His sister is being held captive on a vampire pirate ship. How does he sneak in and save her? He waits till dawn. And walks on the ship and walks away. There's no tension there. Oh, come on. If they went hoopy over Vampirates, I got some titles for them. Some of them, okay. Oh, give them the real ones. Some of them will, of course, because remember we had that huge spectrum. I can't imagine your tough readers going hoopy over that. Or about the one where they sing at the vampires and singing happy songs at them totally defangs them. I thought that was the stupidest thing I ever saw. Until, of course, the monster who would destroy the world who is himself defeated when people sit in a circle and think happy thoughts at him. Sam something monster fighter. You never heard of it because it never went anywhere. They spent $500,000 in advertising on a book that went nowhere because there was no tension in the book. And they thought it was marketed towards boys, and it flopped. tell you the only way you market towards boys is you build up word of mouth. It's the only thing that works because they're never going to trust a marketing firm. They're never going to trust us. If one boy doesn't give it to another boy, you're dead. The way you promote books to boys is you plant them. You give them to boys that you know are going to like them and have big mouths. Cultivate them. A lot of them, by the way, are your sons. If you have a son, you can make him promote books for you. I don't have a problem with that. And the one I just read last week is, anybody read How to Make a Golem and Frighten People? Brand new book. I got to read it in pre-pub. But it's out now, and it's the most frightening thing you ever saw. Literally a rampaging 9-foot clay man who's out to destroy every creature in his path. How do they defeat it? How do three kids get together and defeat the golem? They scratch a heart on his chest, and the heart makes him cuddly. Cuddly. He is the gothic equivalent of a Care Bear. How do we expect these things to really appeal to boys? I'm not a violent guy. By nature, I don't feel a need to give boys violent literature, but I need to give them something that has some tension and some real meat to it, because they won't trust the halfway answers. Those aren't even halfway answers, by the way. Those are the ones I just love to pick on right there. That's just four examples of the worst books that have been given me. There's a graphic literature book that a librarian I respect to the ends of the earth gave me and said, here it is. Here is a graphic literature book with a girl character that boys are going to love. Why? Because it comes down to a battle between this little girl and a troll. And it's a battle to the death to save an entire nation of people. That's absolutely true, and it's a wonderful story right up until the end, until they got to the final battle. Winner takes all. Loser dies. It's a knitting contest. There's something wrong with our approach. We're so afraid of building tension into our stories because we're so, ever since Columbine, we're just so afraid of conflict in our literature. Boys need that conflict. They need the edginess. By the way, that's a great example that I should give to that Catholic school librarian. It's like, here you go. There's absolutely nothing in this book that your school is going to object to. Give them that and see what happens. Watch them laugh at you. It's a knitting contest. Whoever knits the best sweater faster. Whoever isn't done at the end dies. No, they just drop dead from shame, apparently. No explanation. Terrible, terrible, terrible. I get 10 minutes. Let me start wrapping this thing up. One of my favorite authors out there is a man named Gordon Corman. If you want a boy-friendly writer, here he is. If you've got a boy who is, especially those resistant readers, the ones who say, I won't read anything, make a bet with them. You know, I'll dye my hair purple, whatever it is, whatever bet you have to make, and say, you read this book and tell me you don't like it, and I will do X. If you need to give a boy a book and nothing has worked, pick a Gordon Corman book at random and throw it at him. See if it sticks. He's an amazing boy writer. He wrote his first book when he was 12. He was some kid in Canada, some precocious kid, wrote a book, thought it was pretty good. Figured he'd send it in to a publisher. He only knew one publisher, that was Scholastic. You know why that was the only publisher he knew? Not even the book fairs. This is pre-book fairs. He's my age. He's way too old for book fairs. Yeah, the book said, the little flyers. Yeah, sales flyer. You remember those? Yeah, the flyers. So he said, well, I'll send it to Scholastic. He sent it to the only address he had, which, of course, was the address on the flyer, which is a warehouse. That's not the editorial. So he sends in his book in a brown paper envelope, and some forklift operator at a warehouse in Canada gets this package from some kid with a book in it and had the inventiveness and the good sense to read the silly thing, say, hey, that's pretty good, throws it on its forklift, drives it to the other side of the compound where the editorial department is. 2 years later, they published the book. He was 14. They published a book he wrote when he was 12. You know what makes him such a great boy writer? He's still 12. You ever meet him, 5 minutes into a conversation, you swear this is the guy who's going to set a foot to a match in my heel. This is a prankster if there ever was one. He never grew past age 12. And everybody believes him. I mean, he wrote books like Swindle and Married to the Mob. And just these wonderful, not Married to the Mob, that was a TV show. Hollywood Hustle, the Son of the Mob. Son of the Mob, that was it. Was it a movie? I don't know. Didn't watch it, whatever it was. Gordon Corman is this wonderful boy writer. And I get to see a chance to see him all the time. And one of the time that I got to see him, one of the best parts of my job is sometimes there are conferences just for boys in reading. That's all that we're talking about. And whenever they have one of those conferences, the same thing happens all the time. They call me in to speak at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm the boring academic. I'm the bad news. My job is to go up there and turn everyone into a blubbering idiot. I want to make everybody cry. And then there's always some author waiting in the background to come up with the inspirational speech and save the day. Not good for me, but at least I get to see some of my real heroes. I was in Connecticut just a couple of years ago at a conference for children's librarians, and there were 300 attendees or so. I stood up at 9 o'clock in the morning. I sat down at 11, and I had them awash in tears. I did a good job. The next person to step to the podium was Gordon Corman. And you know, Gordon Corman stood up, and basically all he did was challenge these 300 librarians. He said, I want you to consider how many books on the Newbery list, how many books that we have crowned as the greatest book of the year for children, have this very thin plot element of the beloved dog dying. Compared to how many funny books have ever won a Newbery. And 300 librarians stared at the ceiling and you see their lips moving as they counted them out. And you all can do it too. How many great dead dog books can you name? Old Yeller, Sounder, Shiloh, Shiloh 2, Shiloh Season, Higher Power Lucky, Stone Fox. Where the Red Fern Grows. Where the Red Fern Grows is a double, right? Yeah. Two dogs by a cat. He gets just that laugh and sits down because he's made his point. Any one of you can name a dozen great dead dog books. How many funny books have ever won a Newbery? At that point, the answer was none. There were a few books with some laughs at that point. And for years, I asked audiences, and the funniest answer most of them could come up with was Christopher Paul Curtis. That's the funniest book that ever won a Newbery, huh? It's a book about racial violence, people! Oh, God! You know, holes? Maybe. Yeah, it sticks his tongue on the lamppost. I was going to say, now, this is why I keep saying back then, now, finally, we have a humor book. Jack Gantos' book really does fall into the category of humor. They finally gave a humor book a Newbery. But you know what? It was the first one in 59, 60 years. I've forgotten how many at this point. But it doesn't stop there. Nonfiction? Do you know when the last nonfiction book was that won a Newbery? Lincoln Photo Autobiography, Russell Friedman. Good God, that was 22 years ago. Anyone feel old? I bought it for a library. I remember. I was a librarian when that thing won the Newbery. It was 22 years ago. You have to go back 25 years before that to find another one. What? Won a Newbery honor, right? When was that? And it was nonfiction? I'll have to go back and look. I made a pretty close look of the last 50 years, and I didn't. There was nothing the Library of Congress called nonfiction. Library of Congress, if it won the Newbery, Library of Congress must not call it a nonfiction book. There's a couple that there's a question. In fact, the last one that I called nonfiction, I would seriously question it, was Daniel Boone. And remember, that was 47 years ago. Question about whether that was fiction or nonfiction. But they called it nonfiction, so we'll give it to them. Fact of the matter is, Not a whole lot of nonfiction wins a Newbery. A couple of them win an honorary every now and then. Four out of the last 44, if you count the honor books, have been nonfiction. Four out of the last 44 honor books and medal winners were nonfiction. None of them won the medal. What is it? Are nonfiction writers just worse? You never heard of Paul Murphy? Russell Friedman? Again, well, he won one honor since Lincoln put a biography. But clearly, nonfiction doesn't get much consideration. What about sports books? How many sports books have won a Newbery? That one's a joke, of course, because there aren't any sports books. Action-adventure books? Will Hobbs? Come on, Will Hobbs. No, Will Hobbs never won a Newbery. Never will. Gary Paulson's never won a Newbery. By the way, Gary Paulson's best boy book is a humor book, Hatchet. I mean, Harrison. He missed his calling. He should have been a humor writer. Much, much better at that. I used to joke, of course, that Gothic horror never had and never will. Until, of course, the Graveyard Book won. Graveyard Book won the year after I was elected to the Newbery Committee, and they wouldn't let me take my spot. Thanks for those of you who did vote for me, by the way. I was the top vote getter that year. Not only was I one of the top six, so should have been on the committee, I won going away. And then someone on the committee found out who I was, and they changed the rules. They had an emergency meeting and decided that any author under contract for a children's book couldn't be on the Newbery Committee. I, of course, was under contract for Escapade Johnson at the time. 2 years later, they changed the rule back. Oh. Not that I'm taking that personally or anything. But I swear they did Graveyard Book just to shut me up, because I kept telling that story. Fact of the matter is, so much of boys' literature doesn't show up on that list. You say, what do you care? I mean, I don't even read the Newbery books anymore. I don't care. I look them up for interest, but Single Shard was the last one I bothered with. It was terrible. Until, of course, Gantos. I had to go back and read that one. But think about the effect that this has on a boy. Here's all the types of books I really love. And they don't show up on this list for the greatest books for boys, which means that the books that I love aren't real books. And it's not just the Newbery list. I love picking on them because it's just fun. And they're big enough and strong enough they can take it. But you know what? They don't show up on school curriculums either. And they show up very rarely on summer reading lists. Unless, of course, it's a librarian who's writing it. Public librarians, by the way, should be writing summer reading lists. Don't leave that to teachers. It's just not a job that they should be good at, never mind are good at. Boys constantly see that what's considered real reading isn't the reading that speaks to me. So I must be a poor reader. We reinforce that all the time, by the way. I know it's hard to give boys the books they really like. Why? Because we know boys don't read as much or as well as girls. We know that we have less effect on them than we'd like to think, especially you public librarians. We don't have enough face time with kids to have the kind of effect we'd like to. We know we might get one chance to give a boy a book and change his life, a la Laura Lacello handing me The Hobbit. That's a rare opportunity. And when we get that chance, if that boy is going to read one book this year, it sure the hell isn't going to be Captain Underpants. I get it. I feel your pain. Let me turn your thinking around. Because if you think what I'm telling you is, let boys read anything they want, no matter how bad it is, you missed the boat. That's not what I said. What I'm saying is that boys' reading has value simply because boys find value in it. We don't have to like it. It's not our job. We're not the target audience. You're not a 12-year-old boy. And most of you never were. Always keep that in mind. There was never a point where you were the target audience. Your job is to see what boys like, understand why they like it, so that you can give them the next book. Because if that boy reads one book this year, and it's Captain Underpants, he just might read two. For a lot of boys, that would be a huge victory. Let me wrap it up with one final point. Everyone remember how this thing started. A couple of years ago, I wrote the fourth and what turns out to be the last book in the Escapade Johnson series, Escapade Johnson and the Phantom of the Science Fair. And it is literally about a middle school or an elementary school science fair. And Shayna Raven, for her science fair project, breeds a two-headed frog. She's got to win, right? She expects the two heads to be side by side. They're not. Don't beat me to the funny part. I don't mind people stepping on my line. No, but you can see where this is going, right? The frog she breeds has a head on each end. What can this frog not do? It can't go to the bathroom. So it spends its entire two-week, short, miserable life getting larger and larger until the night of the science fair when it literally explodes all over the judges. I wrote that scene as a response, an answer to Grandma Fran and everyone else who questions my point. If we want to reach boys with literature, poop is indeed necessary. Thank you very much for listening to me.
That concludes this part. You guys don't have to leave yet, but this concludes the webinar part. Thank you very much.